Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Wiley Cash is a New York Times bestselling author for his first novel, his debut, which one commentator says is so beautifully written that you'll be torn about how fast to read it. But I'm wondering, how has the great success of his book, A Land More Kind Than Home, affected his life? And then also, when can we see the second book? The new book. Wiley Cash, thanks for dropping by to see us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back on the show.
Well, great to have you here and back in Chapel Hill to talk about your book. And it's not quite a year later, but it's but a lot's happened since we talked on this radio program and on North Carolina Book Watch a few months ago, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's been a lot. It's funny. The hardcover came out April 17th of 2012, and then literally 9 months later, the paperback came out. So it was almost like it'd been gestating like a child, and it was delivered to the day almost. But yeah, lots happened. You know, I've gotten to travel around and meet a couple of folks who've read it and, you know, kind of had the opportunity to see what happens when you launch a book out into the atmosphere and hope something good happens to it.
Well, this is a book that's gotten not only been a sales success, making the New York Times bestselling, I guess you have to say extended list, but that's something every author strives for. And it's been well received critically. I mean, beautiful. You know, the critics have written beautifully about your book.
You know, I've been really fortunate on that end. You know, because you don't think, you know, when you're working on a book, you don't think, gosh, I hope the critics like this. But the day it comes out, you suddenly remember that people might write about it. And I've been really fortunate. We've gotten all really, really overwhelmingly positive reviews. And the New York Times selected it as a notable book of 2012. And that was a shock. You know, that was a shock.
Well, they select 100 books, 50 fiction, 50 books of fiction, and only three North Carolina related authors were on that list. Well, I shouldn't say only three. That's pretty good. That's better. You know, that's really real good. And you were the only debut novelist from North Carolina on that list.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a signal of things to come, I think. But you've been traveling all around for all these many months talking about your book. Have you refined your elevator speech about the book? Or do you start out at a bookstore or someplace and tell about the book, you still giving the same story?
Not really. You know, I give a condensed version of it because I feel like most folks who are going to come to an event now have probably read it.
Yeah, but most people who are listening haven't. So give us a sample of your elevator
speech. Well, the book is about the fallout in the community in Western North Carolina after a young autistic boy is smothered during a healing service at a little church outside of in Madison County, North Carolina. And it's about how does the community deal with that kind of tragic news and how does their past affect how they're going to choose to resolve this tragedy in their community.
That's all that you've really refined. You've really honed it down.
I've gotten it down to 17 words. I like to try to keep it under 30 when you give your book
so
pitch.
You can tweet
it down to 17. Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, that's not enough for me right now. I mean, you're writing. You've got three. Do this real quickly, or as quick as you can. You got three people talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about the three people who are the voices that you've chosen to tell the story.
Yeah, the young boy who suffers this tragedy doesn't speak, and the tragedy befalls him early on, so he can't even tell his own story because he's not present during the novel. So I had to think of other ways to communicate that story. So I gave him a younger brother who's one of the narrators, whose name's Jess. He's 9 years old, and both he and his brother have seen things they should not have seen. And Jess fears that may be why his brother is called into the church. So he bears a certain measure of guilt for this tragedy and a certain measure of, you know, responsibility that only 9-year-olds can harbor, you know, that adults would rationalize. But as a child, he can. The second narrator is a local midwife and the church matriarch. Her name's Adelaide Lyle. She's 81 years old. She's a true believer. She knows the history of the church. She also knows why the members are so intimidated by this minister, Carson Chambliss, who's showed up handling fire and handling snakes and healing people. The final narrator is a local sheriff named Clem, who's responsible for getting to the bottom of what this little boy was doing inside a church that keeps newspaper over its windows. And why will nobody talk about it?
So why would nobody talk about it? I mean, can you give us a hint? Are you going to make us read the book to find out?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons. You know, this minister wields enormous power over this congregation, and he's really gotten them in the palm of his hand, and carries a certain measure of power over not only their spiritual lives but also their physical lives. But also in these small mountain communities, you know, people will lend a helping hand whenever you need it, but they won't ask any questions about why you need that helping hand. And so it's a private place. In some ways, it's a secretive place. So it's no wonder that folks would never knock on a church's door to see what they're doing inside of this church with newspaper over the windows. It just kind of is what it is. And it's not until this tragedy happens that the sheriff is forced to go inside this church and, you know, look in those boxes and look behind the pews and see what's there.
And what this is snake handling, I guess, is illegal in North Carolina.
It is, yeah.
And so that doesn't keep people who are religiously consumed with the scripture, which indicates that drinking poison and handling snakes is part of God's plan and part of that. That doesn't, the illegality of it doesn't keep the believers from participating in it.
No, you know, they're pursuing the truth as they understand it. And, you know, they're appealing to God's law and not man's law. And so, you know, there are still, you know, segments of the religious population in North Carolina that does this. And this book doesn't impugn that at all. But it does investigate our convictions and how far we're willing to take our beliefs, you know, and to what extremes we'll go.
The leader of the—so, yeah, you can develop some sympathy for the—in your book for the— participants in this snake handling ritual, which is dangerous and illegal, but you do not give us much room to be sympathetic to the leader of this, who could be, I mean, you could take him out and he could be the minister of a church that didn't have snake handling or didn't have this illegal activities, and I think you have models for this kind of minister who just takes charge of the lives of people in this congregation.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I didn't set out to write a book about that challenges or, you know, discriminates against religion, but I did want to write about people who take advantage of belief and advantage of faith, you know. And I was raised in Gastonia, right next door to PTL, so I grew up, you know, watching the rise of PTL with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, and then the fall of Jim Baker, and also Jimmy Swaggart down in Baton Rouge. And so I grew up with these models of people that were given incredible power over the spiritual lives of their followers and then completely abused that power. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with spiritual life, but it does mean there's something wrong with investing so much of our own belief in people who claim sway over our spiritual lives.
Well, the name of your preacher in your book, Carson Chambliss. Carson is becoming associated gradually with the kind of villain that we might be talking about. You know, that this might be, he may become a part of the language, but written so powerfully about how evil and manipulative he is that I find myself wanting to say, that guy's a Carson Chambliss kind of preacher.
That would be great.
That'd be great. Anyway, what devices do you, when you're trying to make a villain, but you want, I mean, where do you go to get the catalog of qualities that make a villain who's more than an atypical villain who just strikes out at you, this guy's awful?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think what's powerful about villains is the most powerful thing about a villain is your perception of that villain. Not actually the reality of the villain, but our perception of the villain. And so in A Land More Kind Than Home, Carson Chambliss is talked about more than he's on the page. And so that when he's on the page, it has to be meted out in a way that is unsettling and consistently uncomfortable for both the characters and the reader. So think about when you're sitting in a chair in an uncomfortable position, you can only sit in that chair for so long before you'll get up. Well, whenever you have a villain on the page, you can only keep that villain on the page for so long before the reader will grow accustomed to him or her being on the page. And so I try to have, and even in the novel I'm working on now, my second book, I have a villain who's a narrator. I try to keep him saying as little as possible so that when he does speak, there's weight to it. There's gravity to it. There's a real fear that he puts on the page. Because when we see something too much, we become less afraid of it. And so I have in A Land More Kind Than Home, the sheriff talks about the minister and has his version of where this guy got these scars from, what his violent past is. Well, Adelaide also has her idea of his past and where he got these burns from. The boy's mother has an idea of where he got these burns from and what his past is. So you create this mythology around him based on the perceptions of others. And then when he's on the page, the reader doesn't quite know who he is or what he's going to do, but you know it's going to be uncomfortable. You know it's going to be unsettling. And that was really important to me.
We're visiting with Wally Cash about his book, A Land More Kind Than Home. Paperback version's just come out. Those of you who wait for paperback because you don't want to pay the full price for a hardback, it's time to buy it. Wally Cash and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Wally Cash. Wally Cash is the author of a book that is, it's his debut novel, but it's gotten incredibly kind reviews, more than kind, I mean, laudatory reviews. And the book, which was a sales success as a hardback, is now out in paperback. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wally Cash. We're talking about villains, and you made Preacher the villain. And so you grew up in, as you mentioned earlier, in a region where, though not the mountains, there were plenty of small storefront, small churches with powerful ministers who control their congregations. Were you a part of one of them?
No. I went to a more traditional Southern Baptist church in Gastonia. It was a relatively large church. But, you know, there were, you know, I grew up surrounded by people who speak the language of the evangelical movement. And that's not so different than the language of the charismatic evangelical movement or the holiness movement or the Pentecostal movement, where, you know, everything is tied to either the unseen hand of God or the unseen hand of the devil. So whenever things would happen in the congregation, say, you know, a couple, they were splitting because of infidelity. I remember being a kid and hearing adults say, oh, the devil's working on them. And being a kid thinking about this, you know, this devil with horns and a red tail coming in people's houses and making them do things they shouldn't do. And as a child, you have to rationalize, are they good people? Are they bad people? And how much does this unseen hand affect their lives, you know? And so I grew up in that kind of environment. And it was always interesting to me being a kid, being 10 years old and seeing things and being aware of things that I should, and in the lives of adults that were just open and aired in the congregation, that there's no way I should have known about those things, you know, that were talked about openly in the sermons and stuff.
So the minister in your church, although it was not a snake handling or really a part of the evangelical wing, there was a discipline that the minister felt responsible for preaching about the mistakes of people in the congregation.
Not so much that, but people would get up by their own free will and they would admit these things. They would have, it was like a public confession, you know, couples
would
get up. So
it's a part of a revival kind of service. There was a call for confession.
Almost, but it wasn't just revival. You know, it could happen every Sunday if people felt moved, you know, and there were people getting up confessing addictions of all kinds, confessing infidelities. And, you know, you're a kid and you're sitting there and you're 9, 10 years old and you're thinking, I think I know what's going on. I think I understand this. And even at this age, I know I shouldn't be aware of this. And that's what I wanted Jess to feel, this little boy who sees things he should not have seen about the adults.
This is one of the narrators in your story.
Yeah,
a 9-year-old who's trying to process what's going on in his family, in the religious institution that his family, or at least his mother, is a part of.
Yeah, and he knows, he intuits more than he understands about the lives of adults and about what they're up to and about the relationship between his mother and the leader of the church and all of that. So when this tragedy happens, he is left wondering, did this tragedy happen because my brother and I saw things we shouldn't have seen? What is my responsibility for keeping him out of that church? Did I put him in harm's way by tempting fate, or am I doing this wrong? You know, and I wanted him to feel the confusion that many kids feel in the contemporary church about, you know, what you see versus what you're supposed to believe.
I want to change direction just a little bit, because you've been on the road and you've talked to a lot of people about your book and gotten great questions, I'm sure. And so I wonder what have you learned about your book from talking to people about it that you didn't know when you started this process?
What have I learned about it that I didn't know? Gosh, that's a great question. I think one thing that I'm continually surprised by is that people who I've never met before have read my book. You know, uh-huh. that's a huge shock to me.
Well, yeah, that's got to be real exciting. I mean, those of us who deal with writers and you know, aspire for a little bit of recognition can appreciate the excitement that somebody who's not in your family or in your close network got hold of your book.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
is moved by it.
Yeah, and I think that's something else that I've really been proud of is that people who are staunch believers and are members of the religious community, especially in the South, have really enjoyed this book. You know, I've been contacted by church groups. I've Skyped with church book clubs and talked about the role of faith in the novel and the role of faith in the community. And they've said, you know, you ask some tough questions, but it's only by asking tough questions that people can come to the right answers, mm-hmm. you know. And that's meant a lot to me. So I don't think this is a anti-religion book, but it's not a pro-religion book. You know, it's what I think novels should do in contemporary society, which is ask tough questions.
Well, what do they say are the questions that in the church groups particularly, and this is selfish because, you know, in our Sunday school, we're all the time trying to find literature that's appropriate,
mm-hmm.
you know, that raises respectfully questions about religion, and your book does.
Mm-hmm.
But what are some of the questions that these folks have raised that you maybe weren't, you know, didn't know in advance exactly how people would react?
Yeah, you know, a lot of questions about, you know, what is the responsibility of the church in our community? For example, Adelaide Lyle, she's a woman who sees something going on in her church that makes her feel unsafe. And so she takes the children out of the church and she sticks up to the minister and says, you know, if you're going to be carrying on and handling snakes and doing all this stuff, you can't have kids in this sermon. You can't have kids inside this church. And he doesn't back down. I mean, she doesn't back down from him. And she takes the children out and keeps them safe for 10 years until this tragedy befalls this little boy who dies in this inside the church. And, you know, what is the responsibility of the church after tragedy? How do you heal yourself? How do you come to terms? And how do you own your mistakes and the mistakes that you've allowed people to make in your name? How do you reclaim your faith?
The kinds of people who will be dealing with your literature as a part of their religious experience or their religious education are basically not the kinds of church people that you've been writing about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, be closer to being mainline churches,
yeah.
and things like that. So what is there for a mainline church member to take from this experience? Because I ask the question because they look at it totally different. We would never have snakes in our church.
Yeah, yeah.
Although you remember Doug Marlette's.
Yeah.
You remember we talked about that before?
Yeah, absolutely.
That we're so far out in the country that even the Episcopal church handles snakes.
It's funny because right before this interview, I was talking to a buddy of mine who's an Episcopal priest in Asheville, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, and I talked to him a lot while I was writing this book. And, you know, we talked about the role of faith in our lives and how much do we explain through faith? How much do we explain about our families and our relationships and what kind of role does faith play in our marriages? You know, this is a marriage in this novel that is challenged by faith instead of healed by faith. Mm. And, you know, those are everyday questions that I think people of all religious backgrounds confront. I mean, I married a woman who was raised in a Catholic church in Long Island. So, you know, my Southern Baptist family thought, you know, what in the world have you gotten yourself into? And I had to say, I don't know. We'll find out.
Well, what did happen?
Well, our wedding was interesting. You know, you had the Southern Baptist side just kind of hanging out and not dancing. Then you had the Irish Catholic side just
partying
down.
Could you get a priest to come? co-host it with a Southern Baptist minister?
Or? We actually had a minister. We didn't have a traditional service by any means. We had a friend of mine from the college I was teaching at. He's an ordained minister in the...
A write-in version of a minister.
Yeah, he came down. Well, he, you know, the Disciples of Christ is...
He's a Disciples of Christ minister.
So he did it, and it was wonderful because we're friends, and, you know, it was a really nice thing for us.
Well, let's take a quick break. We're visiting with Wiley Cash, talking about the great success of his debut novel, A Land More Kind Than Home, and it's a paperback edition now. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Wiley Cash is my guest. You've heard of Wiley Cash. If you're a reader, you know that his book, A Land More Kind Than Home, has achieved extraordinary success, including being named as one of the New York Times notable books for 2012. And now those people who defer reading popular books until they come out in paperback can go ahead and get the new paperback edition. To talk about the business of being a writer now. You think the best place you can be is to be a teacher, and so you get your health insurance paid and get a... But if you're a success and you got to travel, it makes it harder to do your job as a writing teacher. How are you blending all this together?
I teach part-time now. I'm no longer teaching full-time, so I'm paying for my own insurance, which was something to get used to. But I teach in a low-residency MFA program out of Southern New Hampshire University, and it's wonderful. I'm there in residence for 5 days in January and 11 days in June, and I work with 5 students over the course of the semester. And it's a real gift for writers who are full-time writers. I have a lot of friends who do this kind of thing. And it keeps you make a little bit of money, and it keeps you active. It keeps you thinking about writing and addressing writing and being around writers who are interested in writing education.
Well, that's interesting, because when we talked last, you were teaching in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What's happened? Where have you moved? Are you
No. I was teaching a 4-4 load with a lot of committee work, and it was just too much. It was 2 full-time mm-hmm. jobs. Mm-hmm. And my wife made it very clear. She said, look, you know, your dream has always been to be a writer. Your dream was never to teach 4 classes a semester at a liberal arts college in West Virginia. And I said, you know, you're right. So
there you are.
Here I am.
Well,
yeah.
I want to, all right, you're leading me away from where I'm meant to go. But talk about teaching writing, and how is it different teaching in one of these low residency, I don't know whether it's highly selective or not, but you've got a smaller group of people mm-hmm. who are clearly deeply motivated because they're paying a lot of money to get mm-hmm. this kind of instruction. How does that differ from teaching undergraduates in a small university?
You know, when you teach undergraduates, you're teaching people who are just beginning to try to decide what kind of writer they want to be. They've just decided to put pen to paper, many of them, and they are there to kind of be guided down the early days of becoming a writer. When you're dealing with graduate students, you're looking at people who have given serious thought and spent serious time writing. And so you're looking to polish them and ask questions and trouble their texts in a way that undergraduates maybe emotionally or intellectually aren't prepared to be troubled or challenged. And so I really ask, you know, of my master's students, I always ask them, you know, what's the goal? What's the goal of this? What's the goal of this scene? What's the goal of this sentence? For undergraduates, you're more concerned with starting on the other end, you know, how do you write a scene? How do you construct dialogue? But with graduate students, I'm really saying, okay, you've got this down, and you understand where it was going. But what is the goal? What is the end result of this? And I always talk about how, you know, literature is supposed to do 2 things. It's supposed to work on the page and off the page. Your words can never just do 1 thing. For undergraduates, you're just concerned with them on the page. You know, how their stories work and how their novels work. But for graduate students, you're really looking kind of beyond that. Like, what are you trying to really communicate here? And how are these characters communicating with each other, but how are they communicating with the reader as well?
Well, you're title from your book comes from Thomas Wolfe, so mm-hmm. you're obviously an admirer of Thomas Wolfe, and from that, the important relationship that he had with his editor.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where I'm wondering how your relationship with your graduate students who have projects at work is the same, is similar to, or and how it's different from that kind of ideal editor,
mm-hmm.
Editor-writer relationship that I guess ideal, but at least important relationship that Wolfe had with his editor.
You know, I think it's pretty similar. I think that I'm probably a little more direct than an editor is in many ways, because an editor, you know, my editor is so wonderful and we're so close with each other that we're always in a conversation about the manuscript.
So it's not so the editor is not saying you got to do this way.
He's, no, not
he's
at all.
He's raising a question. Y'all talk about it so that you're it's a cooperative venture rather than it's a master student relationship.
Exactly. You know, and my editor is wonderfully perceptive. He's from Raleigh, actually, from right down the road. He's wonderfully perceptive, but also really gentle and kind and patient with me. I approach my students. I tell them, look, you know, you're here to learn a craft. You're not here to feel good. So I'm going to address writing the same way I would address you if you were learning landscaping or if you were learning.
I'm going to tell you what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say you need to rework these pages for the next submission. And I really think writing, especially on that level, is learning a craft. It is learning how to be a potter. It's learning how to be a metal worker. It's learning how to be a carpenter. And that's the best way to look at it when you're in that learning stage. With my editor, it's a little more nuanced. It's more, you know, let's talk about the emotions at work in this manuscript. Let's talk about how to turn things up and turn things down. But with students, I'm always talking about objectives. It's kind of demystifying the writing process and demystifying the act of creation. And it's much more about craft than it is with my editor.
With your graduate students, are you learning things from them? Do they teach you?
Oh, yes. Oh, one thing I learned from my graduate students is just work. They just work. They work hard, you know. And it's really inspiring for me. They're turning in 30 pages of prose every month, along with these reading journals. And they have to read 2 or 3 novels a month and write 5, 6 pages on each novel about craft at work in the novel. And they work so hard and are so willing to revise and reimagine and reconsider. And I'll give them pieces of advice, and then I'll catch myself and say, thinking, I don't do that. And here I am telling this person to do that. I should do that, you know? Or I'll see them pulling off something in a manuscript, and I'll think, I need to try that. And so it's this wonderful circular relationship that really benefits me. And I know that sounds so cheesy to say that, but it really benefits me as much, or if not more, than it benefits them. And then twice a year, I get to go to beautiful New Hampshire and hang out with these incredibly talented faculty members and just talk about writing. And, you know, it's just such a nurturing, safe experience. I'm really lucky to be part of this program.
Well, it sounds to me like you're becoming, you know, maybe in a position to be an editor. I mean,
yeah.
and is a author who develops the critical and coaching skills of an editor has, can you do both? Can somebody do both? Or are these distinct, you'd imagine an NFL coach?
Mm-hmm.
He can no longer be a player.
Yeah,
he's got all this experience, but the aging process and the maturing process is taken away for the talent to be a writer. Doesn't mm-hmm. work that way in writing, does it?
No, and I think of my role as being kind of a workshop leader. And being a workshop leader is much different than being an editor. Because the workshop leader is always concerned with the work in progress. And the editor is always concerned with the end, mm-hmm. the end product, the end result. And the editors also acquire manuscripts. They also see strength in things that aren't strong. And workshop leaders have more trouble doing that.
Mm.
And editors are able to identify gems that are unpolished. And workshop leaders aren't as concerned with that. And so I feel like my editor, when he acquires a work, he sees what it is at that point, what it's going to be in the middle, and what the end result could be, And then beyond that, how it's going to be marketed, how sales are going to react to it. And so it's this instantaneous, almost lifetime experience of the work. Whereas I'm only concerned with the 30 pages I've got on my desk at that time and in making those as strong as they can be. And I think it's a different skill set. And I think it requires much more imagination and much more intelligence than what's required of a workshop leader, which is what I think I am.
Well, with this experience, I mean, if you had a land more kind than home put in front of you, not as the editor and the marketer, but as the workshop leader, what would you tell yourself about it?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about all the drafts that I worked on over the course of this book's creation, which was 5 or 6 years. Yeah. You know, how many times I had it in a workshop or under the eye of a great reader like my wife or one of my close friends who are writers, and how many times this thing had to be reimagined to be what the book is now. I don't know. What I like to do when I teach is I like to find models. I like to say to a student, here's what I think you're trying to do, and here's a writer who does this really well. You need to read that and see what you can learn. And so I think with A Land More Kind Than Home, I would say, hey, you know, you're borrowing heavily from the Southern oral tradition, so you need to go read somebody like Ernest Gaines. You need to go read somebody like even a Thomas Wolfe novella, like The Web of the Earth. You know, you need to go read these things and see how the oral tradition unfolds itself in Southern writing.
And would you say, and look for some of these things, or you just say, go figure out what you get out of it?
I would say, look at how voice builds character. Look at how these characters don't have to tell you about themselves. You know, I was raised in a small town. You know, look at how they talk about being from a small town, and then you'll learn what that small town means to them instead of having them tell you what that small town means to them. You know, small town life was very important to me. We'll show it being important to them. My faith is really important. I'm a true believer. We'll show it through their actions, show it through their interactions. And, you know, that's the great thing about the Southern literary tradition. You have all these rich examples of these things. And that's what a background in literature has done for me. You know, I've studied literature for 12 years of my life, you know, at all levels. And so whenever I hit a spot where I'm stuck, I just think, oh, you know, Kay Gibbons figured this out for me already. I'll just go see what she did. Or so those models are so important. We learn from models in every other aspect of our life, from how to talk to how to walk to how to shoot a basketball. Writing's the same thing.
We're visiting with Wally Cash. We're talking to him in the context of the recent release of the paperback version of his successful novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm talking to Wally Cash about, well, in and around his now not new book, A Land More Kind Than Home, but a new edition in paperback just published. But I got so interested in all the things about the earlier book. If I don't ask you right now, we're not going to have time to talk about what you're doing now. And when we talked earlier, I got real excited because you outlined a book that took place in and around Gastonia, baseball player, having trouble with family, relationship with his daughter. And that just, I couldn't wait to read it. And now you're telling me I might have to wait a little while.
I think it's going to be out in November of 2013.
Of this year.
Yeah.
So you're done.
That's what we're shooting for. I finished a draft. I've still got some work to do on it, but it is about a washed up minor league baseball player from Gastonia who kidnaps his two daughters from a foster home and decides he's going to be a dad to them, even though it's clearly too late. But it's set in the summer of 1998. So I'm really, really proud of it. It's got three narrators, just like A Land More Kind Than Home. The first narrator is his 12-year-old daughter. Her name's Easter.
The kidnappee.
She knows her dad is a loser, but she really wants him not to be. The second narrator is a bounty hunter who is hired to find this baseball player.
Who's looking for him? His wife? His former wife?
Well, this baseball player has kidnapped these girls because he's found some money. So he steals this money, and the bounty hunter is sent to find him. And they have a relationship because the bounty hunter was blinded 10 years earlier by a pitch that ended his baseball career that my hero, Wade Chesterfield, threw. So he's out for blood, he's out for revenge, he's out for money. And the final narrator is a private investigator hired by the girls' maternal grandparents in Alaska. They've never met these little girls, but they were in the process of adopting them when they disappear. And the local police aren't really dealing with these grandparents in a way they see fit, so they hire an investigator to feed them information.
So you got family, a chase, a revenge motive.
That's right. Yeah, I'm trying to cram it all in baseball.
And baseball.
And it's set in the summer of 1998, which is the year of the home run race between McGuire and Sosa.
So you got drugs in there, too.
I do. Yeah, the bounty hunter is hopped up on steroids. He is filled with rage and revenge and trying to make sure things don't end well. So we'll have to see if they do or not.
How did this story come to be?
It came from a lot of places, which is, you know, where stories come from. But the purest thing I can trace it back to is to my wife. She's from Wilmington, North Carolina. And she was telling me one day that when she was a little girl, she played softball and she could never learn to slide. And so at night during the summertime, when her dad would get off work, they'd go to the ball field in her neighborhood and he would teach her how to slide. And I thought that was such a sweet story. But it's not necessarily a good story because there's no tension. So I had this image of a little girl sliding into third base, standing up and dusting herself off, and then seeing her dad sitting in the stands and thinking, why in the world is he here? Why has he come back into my life? And that's how the book opens.
That's the opening image that caught you, and that's the central... Oh, the central image that keeps you telling a story.
Absolutely,
around that image.
Yeah, it's that shock that this little girl who's 12, having not seen her dad for 2.5 years, they're living in a foster home, their mother's passed away, and one day he's back, and she is less than happy to see him, but also curious about what he's got up his sleeve.
We've been talking about A Land More Kind Than Home, which is just riveted to religion, and did you just get away from the church in this new book?
Yeah, there's no mention of anything.
They don't go. These guys don't go to church.
They're too busy running from the law to do that. They don't talk about it. No, it's
no prayers, no bedtime prayers, no nothing. I mean, you just completely abandoned.
None of that. Yeah, that story ran its course through me, and now I've started this other one.
Well, all right. So you've almost finished this book, and what have you got? Little images running around in your head that might be the basis for a third novel?
I do, yeah. I'm pretty set on writing about the Loray Mill strike in 1929 down in Gastonia. That's where I think I'm going to go with this third one.
Well, tell us about that strike. This is not unusual because up in this area we had textile strikes, mm-hmm. and Doug Marlette wrote his debut novel, set in that context.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where would we go with that?
You know, the Loray Mill strike was really a foundational event, not only in Gastonia and in North Carolina, but in the Southern labor movement. You know, it's kind of the thing that killed Southern labor. But, you know, these mill employees all came down from the mountains with the promise of big money in the mills and got down there and realized not only was there not a lot of money in the mills, but there was a high expectation for work with very little compensation. And this famed balladeer named Ella Mae Wiggins rose up out of this strike and ended up being murdered by people tied to the mill to kind of silence her voice. She was becoming nationally known as a leader of this strike. And I've always been curious about the events that led up to that murder and the fallout. The people who were convicted, who were charged with it, were let off in a matter of hours, you know, kind of a sham trial. And I was always interested in the community, what Gastonia was in 1929, being from there. Nobody talked about it growing up. It wasn't until I went to college that I found out about this thing that happened in Gastonia.
Well, I can't wait. Can't wait for the second. And now you got me... Can't wait for the
third
Raleigh Cash. In the meantime, we'll enjoy through paperback this very popular and well-received book, A Land More Kind Than Home. Thanks, Wally Cash.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been D.G. Martin with Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.